Airlines Confidential with Ben Baldanza and Scott McCartney is made possible with support from Pratt & Whitney, committed to working smarter, cleaner, and greener today for a more sustainable tomorrow. Learn more at PrattWhitney.com. DoHop, revolutionizing travel connectivity. Learn how to unlock unlimited connections simply at DoHop.com. And Cirium, the world's most trusted source of aviation analytics. Visit Cirium.com. We also welcome your business's support. Info at airlinesconfidential.com.
Welcome to Airlines Confidential. I'm Scott McCartney, hoping everyone survived the eclipse with sanity and retinas intact. And since it's the second week of April, it's time to celebrate the end of March Madness. Congratulations to South Carolina on the women's side and Connecticut on the men's side. Soon it will be time to talk first quarter earnings, our own version of airline March Madness. And to prepare for that, we're going to talk airline pricing today with Cirium, the data company. Cirium has done some very interesting number crunching on 2023 fares, and I think it says a lot about the state of the airline industry. So welcome to all the madness, Ben Baldanza.
None of our teams won, Scott, but I'm looking forward to seeing who wins in first quarter airline earnings, and I'm looking forward to talking with Kevin O'Toole from Cirium. In airline news this week, it's proxy season, so we're finding out how much airline CEOs earning last year. Scott Kirby set the bar high for airline CEOs with total compensation of $18.6 million in 2023, according to United's proxy statement filed last week. That was close to double the $9.8 million he took in during 2022. His base salary last year was a little more than $1 million. He got $6.6 million in bonuses and $10.7 million in stock awards. It seemed pretty typical for the CEO of a big, high-profile company, Scott.
As you know, Ben, I teach business journalism at Duke, and each student has a company to follow. This past week, I had them do a scavenger hunt of fun facts in the proxies of their companies. And what we found is that Scott Kirby is no Elon Musk. No surprise, even to the students diving into executive compensation for the first time. Total compensation for Mr. Musk, who prefers the title Techno King rather than CEO, was $55.8 billion. Yes, billion with a B, though that was struck down by a Delaware judge in January. In 2022, Tim Cook of Apple took home $99 million, and that got him only number 10 on the Wall Street Journal's list of highest paid CEOs. The median compensation for S&P 500 chief executive officers is about $14 million a year. So we could say Scott Kirby is a bit above average, but not much more. For 2023, Robert Jordan at Southwest trailed Scott by a large margin. Bob earned total compensation of $9.3 million. For 2022, Ed Bastian's total compensation was $9.6 million. Delta will file its 2023 year proxy later this month, and you can expect Ed's total comp to go up just like Scott's. Robert Isom for 2022 was at $4.9 million. While his salary has gone up, his stock awards have declined in value. Ted Christie at Spirit earned $3.2 million in 2022. So it'll be interesting to see how Spirit rewards him for 2023. I'm looking forward to seeing the proxies of these airlines later this month. One more CEO worth noting, Ben. Dave Calhoun at Boeing took home $22.5 million in 2022. And late Friday, when Boeing was hoping everyone was focused on eclipse planning or maybe Caitlin Clark and women's basketball, the company slipped its proxy statement in, disclosing that Calhoun got a 46% raise in 2023 to total compensation of almost $33 million. Because Boeing had such a good year, I guess. Actually, it probably wasn't that bad a year. Remember, the MAX 9 door plug flew off on January 5th.
Some of those numbers, especially Musk's, seem really egregious to me. CEOs deserve good pay, I think, but most should be in stock awards to ensure alignment with shareholders. While I'm sure that's true in these examples, they still seem really high to me. Maybe to support these kind of payouts, those earners should return stock in years when their company underperforms. Scott, speaking of compensation, Alaska Airlines said it will receive $160 million from Boeing to compensate for 737 MAX 9 incident and groundings. Expect to see a big number owed to United Airlines as well for the MAX 9 problems. That model of the MAX was grounded for 3 weeks, of course, after an Alaska MAX 9 lost a door plug in flight because bolts removed during manufacturing by Boeing were never reinstalled. I also expect we'll soon see reimbursements from Pratt to some airlines for aircraft groundings due to their engines.
Yeah, your perspective on executive compensation is really interesting, Ben. This is a problem throughout corporate America, right? And so airlines are certainly, a small part of a much bigger problem.
And I'd like to send out congratulations to the team at Boom Supersonic, which successfully flew its XB-1 demonstrator last month. Boom faces lots of challenges, reducing the noise of sonic booms so it can exceed the speed of sound over land and overcoming environmental concerns. Because moving a relatively small number of people at very fast speeds is environmentally less efficient, perhaps, than conventional commercial travel. We'll see how it all works out. But it is very exciting to see progress on new airplanes.
Absolutely. Another note, Ben, if your Global Entry membership is expiring this year, you might want to go ahead and renew. On October 1st, the government will raise the 5-year membership to $120 from $100. Customs and Border Protection says this is the first price increase in 15 years, and it's still one of the best deals around, especially if you get it covered by a credit card benefit. Global Entry is truly one of the best government programs ever. It improves security, speeds up travel, and makes it all more convenient. Plus, you get TSA PreCheck with it. Nobody likes higher fees, but this one is well worth it. And it is with sadness that we report tough times in Oakland, California, Ben. Not only is the city on the east side of the bay losing its baseball team to Sacramento next year, while a new stadium is built in Las Vegas on the site of the Tropicana, but also the airport announced it wants to change its name to San Francisco. Well, more specifically, San Francisco Bay Oakland International Airport. And guess who objects? San Francisco. I object too. That's much too confusing for many travelers, even though the airport code would remain OAK. It's one thing to add someone's name to an airport name, and sometimes the name becomes the name, like O'Hare or Logan or LaGuardia or Kennedy. But I have a hard time seeing San Francisco on one side of the bay and San Francisco Oakland on the other side.
Things must really be bad in Oakland if they think taking the name San Francisco is a step up. San Francisco has certainly had its own share of image problems lately, and I agree that this name change will cause some confusion. One other interesting note, Southwest Airlines announced it acquired a sustainable fuels company, Sapphire Renewables. The company has been backed by the U.S. Department of Energy as a project aimed at scaling production of sustainable aviation fuel. Southwest had created a division to manage its investments in sustainable aviation fuel, generally fuel produced from oils from plants or algae. We've seen lots of airlines invest in sustainable aviation fuel companies, and Delta even bought its own oil refinery because fuel is such an important part of the airline business. It'll be tough for airlines to manage fuel companies and tough for them to provide all the necessary capital funds to create a new sustainable aviation fuel industry at scale big enough to reduce airline environmental impact significantly. While this is a good move by Southwest, it doesn't change the fact that the industry is very far away from scaling up to filling every plane with sustainable aviation fuel.
Yeah, and Ben, I still believe this is an area where the government really needs to step up. Tremendous government support has gone to the electric vehicle industry, and I applaud that. It's needed to get that rolling. and the impact that can have on carbon emissions is significant. Plus, electric cars are really fun to drive. But aviation is not getting the same kind of support, and I don't think this low-margin industry can be expected to pay for development of a new fuel source all by itself. We haven't seen the big energy companies, the Exxons and Chevrons, jump into this. To really make sustainable aviation fuel work, bigger powers are going to be needed.
I agree that the government should step up in this. I think that their EV targets aren't really achievable, especially on the big truck side. But if we're that focused on the roads, why not the air too? SAF at full scale would require a large land grab too, so we'd have to be sure as a society that this the best use for that land, however, perhaps food, fossil energy, or housing makes more sense.
Yeah, totally. You know, one vision is if you could do it from algae, you could have fuel ponds all around airports and really reduce trucking costs and everything else, but that would require refining. I don't know. It's a very complicated problem. What's not complicated is that Airlines Confidential wouldn't exist without our sponsors. We want to thank Pratt & Whitney. At Pratt & Whitney, the pursuit of more sustainable aviation is foundational. For decades, Pratt & Whitney has been at the forefront of revolutionary advancements in aircraft propulsion technology. And by working smarter, cleaner, and greener today, they are committed to supporting the aviation industry in its goal of reaching net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. Learn more about Pratt & Whitney's smarter technology, cleaner fuel, and greener business at prattwhitney.com.
And we want to thank DoHop, which is revolutionizing travel connectivity. DoHop is a travel technology provider enabling airlines to expand their networks, offer more connectivity, create additional partnerships, and focus on improving the customer experience with more offers, services, and travel options. Airlines benefit from generating additional revenue, lower costs, and maintaining full customer ownership. Plus, in the event of travel disruptions, DoHop works with airlines and offers assistance in helping passengers reach their final destination. Visit DoHop.com. That's DoHop.com.
In addition, we want to thank Cirium. Cirium offers the most accurate and precise data and analytics to enable airlines to optimize planning, operations, and passenger services. The right intelligence drives operational efficiencies, enables you to predict market shifts, and helps airlines respond quickly to maximize revenue, manage costs, and seize commercial opportunity. Visit Cirium.com for more.
Speaking of Cirium, we are thrilled to welcome Kevin O'Toole to the podcast.
Our data sponsor, Cirium, put together a very interesting airfare study recently. We wanted to learn more details about it. So we're joined by Kevin O'Toole, who is Chief Strategy Officer for Cirium. Kevin has been with Cirium since 2005. Before that, he edited Airline Business Magazine, so he certainly knows the ups and downs and ins and outs of the industry. Kevin, it's very good to have you with us on Airlines Confidential.
No, great to be here, Scott.
Let's start with some of the basics. Where does Cirium get fare data? Is this actual tickets purchased or some kind of monitoring of prices for sale in the market?
Oh, that's a big question. So we have, I think, north of 300 sources that we use to build the model. But the main ones, they're government data. So that's the actual prices, especially the DOT, as you know. I mean, with our DO product is used throughout the whole of the airline industry in the US, but around the world too. The second, probably the biggest source, I would say, is... we also have MIDT data to supplement that. We don't tend to use that in the US, of course, because we have better data, but we use a lot of MIDT from the usual Western sources and in China as well for international. We don't do domestic China. I think the third big source would be Webfares, where we have a source of Webfares coming in from a partner. And that really is useful for allocating or calculating average prices for the average fares for low cost, which are just not in any of the other. But as well as that, the reason we have 300 sources is you have to have a lot of other sources out there so that you can have control totals for your model, which allows you to look at when you're and actually capacity data for the cabins, of course, so that you can really apply that as a global, to get a global market estimate. And they're always estimates. There's no one who has all of that data. And if they did, I'm sure that the Department of Justice would look very unfavorably on them. So, yeah, so we're modeling it out. We've been doing that for about 25 years. One thing I would say is that the fares data is the base fare data, is the ticket price data, not with the ancillaries. And I know that that's probably something that we need to add in the future as it gets bigger. I know with Ben on the call, of course, Spirit itself has been up to about, well, north of 50% of the passenger revenue now comes from non-ticket data.
I think the main finding was that U.S. domestic airfares in 2023 were up 9% compared to 2019. You know, we talk about 2019 because it's our pre-pandemic benchmark. While 9% sounds like a healthy increase, the consumer price index, our measure of inflation, was 19% higher. Was the smaller airfare increase surprising?
In a way, it wasn't. I mean, it was encouraging in some respects that there had been an increase at all, because they'd obviously with the unprecedented nature of the COVID shutdown, it was not clear what was going to come back. I think, as a general rule of thumb globally, we'd seen airfares go down by about roughly in inflation in just in real terms, by about 2% a year. So if you're over 4 years, you expect the airfares to be slightly down. So 9% is good to come back. But the question now is whether, for the industry at least, is whether they maintain any discipline on that and keep it going, and whether it's becoming more stable. I think it is becoming slightly more stable for sure. It's probably the airfares are not going to go up too much more, but we'll see. We'll see.
So that gets into some of our other questions. Cirium has really great data on seats flying and airline capacity, and airfare is so much a function of supply and demand. I imagine U.S. domestic capacity is now well above 2019 levels. So do you think the fact that fares didn't keep up with inflation as a result of capacity increases?
Yeah, to an extent. So you saw some real recovery in the fares during, especially during 21, the middle of 21 through to 22 in the US market, which was back really of the major markets first. Many of the other markets, of course, Asia Pacific was kept down because of the continued lockdowns, even in 22 in China. And Europe was really, really struggling to get the capacity back, whereas the US had a more of a steady rise, really, from 21. So it hadn't been startling. The if you look at it, 23 against 2019, there'd been a steady sort of, probably about in the through to the end of the summer, probably about 4%. It was ahead of, in terms of seat capacity, ahead of where it had been in 2019. In September, October, November, it suddenly went up by 7 or 8%. And I think that's where we saw the competition increase and therefore the fares begin to come under pressure again. So you can see that the fares begin to weaken from where they had been the year before.
U.S. domestic fares fell 4% from August to December last year. And fares in December were actually 9% lower than December 2022. So there was weakness in pricing last fall. Did that also correlate with capacity increases? Or is that maybe more about lower demand for tickets?
Yeah, it's difficult to know whether the demand, the underlying demand is falling. It feels to me that it isn't. I think it has been that there was, it's difficult for airlines, as you know, Ben, to adjust, especially for the majors, to adjust in a fine way towards the demand. So my feeling was, looking at the figures, that it had heated up over the summer. It was still kept fairly restrained growth, but as you came into the winter season, it was just going ahead, and they were adding new aircraft in there without and new flights, without that having the demand to keep it up. It's only, you know, you're right about December. It was a surprising, it was sort of out of kilter with the rest. So we're looking at it in January now. It appears to be a little bit more stable, although January is not a good month to gauge it by. So we'll have to look forward. We won't know, I think, until possibly the middle of the year whether we're seeing a return to fare decreases or whether it will stabilize.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm eager to hear what airlines are going to say when they start reporting first quarter earnings, which will be coming up soon.
And you look also, actually, Scott, at the at some of the input price increases. Now, if oil price goes up and wages go up, which is beginning to happen, of course, that's when you begin to get some pressure on also pressure on cost. And if yield is going down at the same time, then maybe we are just back again where we've been before, which is airlines starting to lose cash.
Yeah. So fares for travel within Europe were up 12% over 2019. I thought that was really interesting. It was a bigger increase than in the U.S., but I suspect it's still not as high as the rate of inflation in Europe. What do you think is behind the bigger increase in Europe?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? There's a few things. I think the headline piece is that Europe is possibly about 6 months behind the US recovery. And reasons for that, there's several sort of headline reasons that you could give for it. If you remember when restrictions were lifted in Europe in the beginning of 22, so in the first quarter, about February, March time, it was done really quite quickly. The governments just announced, yes, you know, we're lifting the lockdown. We're allowing, for example, people to fly. Because it wasn't coordinated, it never is in Europe, because it's made up of dozens of individual national countries. And when it comes to things like COVID rules, they are all still national country, you know, still nations, independent nations. So it was less coordinated than it was in the States. It was less smooth. And they really, really struggled in the summer of 22 to loft enough capacity. It wasn't necessarily that the aircraft weren't there or the pilots, but there weren't any ground crews. A lot of people in the airports had gone off. We found the cabin crew, for example. There was a huge pull for them to go and work in hospitality, which had come back earlier. So it was a real struggle in the summer of 22 to get that capacity lofted. So it's been a fairly precipitous increase for the Europeans, but they are slightly behind the curve. So I would imagine that Europe would somewhat slow down again as the US has, but we'll see. I was going to say there are some other demographic, if you like, or some underpinning in Europe, which is just different. So Europe has you're probably aware, has a really bell-shaped traffic graph. So because we have a lot more holiday, I guess, in Europe, which we're lucky to do, the peak is much more pronounced in the middle of the year and much less so at the end. It's much, much flatter in the US and in most of the rest of the world. So you do get that. That's one of the things that happens. So when you have those traffic increases in the summer, it is really tough if you're trying to reel off capacity. I think there's one other piece, which might be, it's probably another podcast, a different podcast, but I would say in the US, the major US airlines have always made, you know, the largest part of their money and profit actually when they make it in the domestic market. It's really important for them. In Western Europe, generally speaking, airlines have not made a lot of their revenue and certainly not much of their profit, if any, from flying domestically the majors. Obviously, Ryanair is different. And it's a comment we often hear that, and you probably heard it yourself, that in the US, I think the majors have come to live better with the low cost. They've differentiated, especially with the ultra low costs like Spirit. They've had to differentiate themselves, and they've sort of come to an accommodation, and they sort of have come back to understanding where they should have a differentiated product. I think in Europe, they're still half competing with it and still half not. So I think the Europeans have, it's just a different feel to that market. But as I say, it's probably another podcast.
Looking at transatlantic fares, which is very timely as we head into what will likely be a record summer for flying across the Atlantic, you found that transatlantic economy fares were 14% higher than in 2019. Again, more expensive, but at a lower than the pace of inflation. We heard a lot of complaints about really hefty fares to Europe last summer. What's your assessment of transatlantic?
Yeah, it's true. So if you'd have flown in 22, say, and then you'd flown again in 23, especially early in the year, you'd have seen a really strong double digit, 20% increase in fares, and that would have really hurt. That's not necessarily the case that it was quite so high against 2019, but it was substantially higher. I mean, it was maybe about 10% higher than it was in 2019. So definitely transatlantic had, there's been some constraints on capacity. There was a huge built-up demand, I think, because there's a lot of people would normally have flown that route from Europe to the US and vice versa, which just hadn't been able to do so for, 5 years at that point. But you did also see, I think, towards the end of last year, when you get into the second half of the year, the fares had just begun to come down again from where they'd been in 22, still ahead of where they were in 2019. So it looks as though we don't know what will happen in the summer. Of course, it could be that it depends how much capacity is lofted, but it did look as though that fare increase was beginning to weaken after the first 4 or 5 months.
You also found that business class fares were actually 3% lower than 2019. Not just lower than the rate of inflation, but cheaper in dollars or euros. In December, business class fares were 7% lower than December 2019. Why so much pressure on business class?
Yeah, I think that's that really comes from a general lack of corporate flying to the same degree as it was in 2019. This recovery has been very much led, as I'm sure you're aware of, by retail flying. So the corporations are just not back. And I know, like in the States, American and others have had quite strong programs to sell business, first and business class to via their websites, via retail with good prices, just to get them filled. So if you look at the returns that you get, which is probably the fairest, the best proxy for it, when you look at the returns through Sabre and Amadeus and the big GDS that handle all of those corporate agency fares, they're still down by 20% at the same time or so. The whole of last year, at the same time as traffic overall is pretty much recovered. So I think that what we've seen is a retail recovery, which starts filling from the back, but we haven't yet seen the business, that corporate business traffic come back, which had traditionally filled the front of the aircraft. And there are some questions about whether it will come back to the same degree. There's some other pressures on it. I mean, not only are corporations obviously wary that the economy remains some little bit fragile, but they also, especially in Europe, have to now report on sustainability and show that how they're going to reduce overall Scope 3 emissions, which includes air travel as one of the largest. In fact, about something of the order of about 35% of a global, global corporations. Scope 3 emissions would come from air travel.
Last summer, transatlantic seat capacity was up 18% compared to the prior year. Demand for trips to Europe soared, and airlines delivered with lots of additional flights that filled up. Your data show this summer is poised for the same kind of increase once again. In July, there will be 375,000 more seats flying across the Atlantic than in July 2023. Is there a risk here of overcapacity? Or if you fly it, they will come.
Of course, as you well know, there's a difference between filling a seat and filling it profitably. Mm-hmm. So, I'm sure that the traffic will be back. It's all pointing in that direction, especially on the North Atlantic. whether they will keep the yields, the seat yield at the same price, whether they'll be able to maintain fares, I begin to think they might doubt. I might doubt it, partly because without the corporate traveller coming back, who would typically be paying the top dollar, it is difficult to get those average fares back to where they were. We'll see. I mean, if the economy takes an upturn, if business gets more confident, maybe. But the world is not a very stable place at the moment, and I think that's having an impact too.
Yeah, another uncertainty is all the capacity constraints. I'm curious what you think airfare would be like if we didn't have the capacity constraints we're seeing from Pratt & Whitney engine repairs, from Boeing delivery problems, from shortages of air traffic controllers in the U.S. If a lot more planes were flying, would pricing be even weaker?
I once wrote a leader when I was writing Airline Business. I wrote a leader, and it was the three laws of airline dynamics, of which the first line is that airline profitability seeks its lowest form of entropy.
Yes.
And one of the others, which is probably relevant here, was that every impact on capacity has an equal and opposite impact on yield. Mm-hmm. So it depends. I think it's a twin story, really. So a lot of the A380s have not come back to the same degree. Mm-hmm. And certainly the 74 looks as though it's more or less over. So a few have come back, but not as many, and some of them will never come back. So it does look for the longer haul markets as though the capacity will increase because they're ramping up production, but it probably be slightly slower than it might otherwise have been because of the need to ramp up production. If you were looking and you were mentioning the Pratt & Whitney GTF engines, of course, there's a whole fleet of aircraft now that have to come out for a month or so each to have those engines looked at. On top of that, there's the disaster at Boeing, really, with the MAX 9. And also just generally, both Airbus and Boeing are really struggling at the moment to keep up, to get their production rates up to where they wanted them, where they promised them at the beginning of the year. So there could be some capacity constraints, especially on the short haul aircraft, which do constrain that capacity. On the other hand, I remain skeptical that the industry is quite as, the question's out there, I suppose, but has it really found a new discipline, or is this will this, as soon as they have the opportunity, will we add too many aircraft and it'll go back to the same situation of falling yields and at the same time as rising traffic? So I think the jury's still out. I would like to believe that the airline industry's come back from COVID in better shape than it went in, and with a strong desire, for example, we find all the time to begin to do that digital transformation, which will give them the understanding and the some more discipline about. But you can never tell with the industry. I mean, as soon as the world looks as though the demand's come back, you can easily, very quickly, move from a situation of profitability, of record profits and high yields, back to a situation where you're just knocking chunks out of each other, and too much capacity is reducing fares. So I'm not sure. If you ask what would happen if there was no constraints, I think the industry almost certainly would be right back in a position of falling yields and rising traffic. But that's not going to happen in the near term, so we'll see.
Tell our listeners how they can find Cirium and subscribe to reports if interested.
Yeah, well, I can tell you how you can find us, which is fairly straightforward, which is just go to the website, cirium.com, and it's all there. There's a lot of information which just general listeners can look for there. Some ThoughtCloud pieces, including the piece that I write on fares, which I suppose is getting a little bit out of date now, but I mean, there's more coming all the time. And of course, we have a whole host of products, but you can see them there.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much. Thank you for the data. Thank you for the insight. I think this has been both fascinating and very timely. I think it's a really interesting situation for the industry and going to be fascinating to see which way things go this year for airlines. So we appreciate your time.
We'll have to come back in the fall and see if it happened.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Cheers. Bye.
And we'll be back with more on Airlines Confidential in a minute.
Promotional consideration provided by TheAirchive.net, celebrating 20 years with a fresh new look and over 60,000 items of AvGeek goodness. It's the hub of air transport history, and you're welcome aboard. TheAirchive.net.
Thanks again to Kevin. I think fair data is really important and hard to get, and Cirium has some really important insights to offer. So I'm glad we had that discussion. I want to remind listeners that Airlines Confidential will be on stage for a keynote podcast at Aviation Festival Americas on May 15th in Miami Beach. This is the 16th year for Aviation Festival Americas, and it brings together more than 250 influential leaders from the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you'd like to attend, Airlines Confidential listeners can get a 50% discount by going to airlinesconfidential.com, clicking on the Aviation Festival banner ad, and using the promo code AC50. It's going to be a great event, and we are really looking forward to being part of it.
In the mailbag this week, Pete in Tucson responded to a comment I made about security for all commercial flights. Pete says, "I sympathize with Ben's comment that all scheduled charter flights should include passenger security screening. However, he expressed his desire that all charter flights should require passenger security screening. This is simply not practical. A significant percentage of charter flights are flown from secondary airports, some with multiple FBOs that have no practical option for such screening. It's a worthy but unmanageable goal." Thanks, Pete. I wasn't necessarily suggesting that charter flights need before a flight security like TSA. Perhaps, though, they can at least do a quick background check or scan against no-fly lists at the time the charter is booked.
Yeah, I certainly think more could be done, but very interesting discussion. Our previous correspondent, Skip Lagger Wannabe, has another question. "Ben and Scott, I recently flew one of the big three airlines between two of its hubs and struck up a conversation with a flight attendant who was deadheading. This flight attendant lived where our flight was taking off from and was based where our flight was landing because of a lack of seniority. I get rewarding employees based on seniority to some extent, but a system that makes an employee deadhead for a multi-hour flight just to report to work sounds tiring and wasteful. Why does this happen?" Well, Skip, this is basically commuting in the airline world. In most businesses, when you relocate, you actually have to move. Work from home is certainly changing that, but work from home doesn't work for airline crews. In the airline world, your schedule is based on your seniority, and you may be able to bid a more desirable schedule at a different base than your home. You may not want to live there. Or you may be bidding different bases all the time and moving around so much that relocating your family makes absolutely no sense. So one of the perks of the job, if you will, is the ability to fly to another base for work. It's not without its costs. Sometimes you have to bunk in a shared crash pad apartment, and it certainly can be tiring, as you know. It's a long-held tradition, one that I thought would get more scrutiny after the Colgan air crash, which was all about the overnight commute and the lack of adequate rest for the pilots, and not about their hours of experience before hiring. The reality is that companies like the flexibility and don't want to pay to move families across the country, and pilots and flight attendants like the flexibility as well. Not all do it, but plenty do, and no one wants to touch that electric third rail by suggesting that it's not wise.
Deadheading is prevalent among the U.S. airlines. It's a decision that airlines basically lost to airline unions decades ago. In Europe, the low-cost airlines like Ryanair and Wizz use a basing system. A certain number of planes, plus the crew to fly and fix them, are based in one city. Then the planes just fly out and back to that city. This way, most crew are home at the end of each day, and the airlines buys few hotel rooms.
Makes a lot of sense. But then again, probably impractical for such a large market as North America. Well, that's all the April madness we can muster.
Have a great week, and thanks for listening.
This podcast is produced by Mass Media. Info at massmedia.net.